book is asking us to think about what does war mean? What is the impact of war? The war, warfare is never contained in boxes that only deal with the people who are fighting. It's a very almost artificial way to study war, is to say, well, we're going to study this war, but we're only going to study it from the perspective of those who took part militarily. It misses so much of the nuance and the importance and the implications of state violence across in any moment of time, but in particularly this moment of time.
This was the voice of Professor Maartje Abbenhuis on her new book about the history of the First World War as a global conflict that impacted the daily lives of people not only in Europe, but all over the world. My name is Anne van Maurik, and in this episode of Neil Rewind, I will interview Maartje and the other co-author of the book, Professor Ismay Tamas. Maartje and Ismay, welcome to the Neil Rewind podcast. I'm really happy to interview you on your new book, Global War, Global Catastrophe, Neutrals, Belligerents, and the Transformations of the First World War. Could you please both introduce yourself briefly to us?
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me on this podcast. My name is Ismay Tamas. I work at the NIOT as a senior researcher and program leader. And I also hold a professorship at Utrecht University.
Hello. So lovely to be able to be here on this podcast, Anna. My name is Maartje Abbenhuis. I'm a professor in modern history at the University of Auckland, which is in New Zealand. And I'm a historian of international affairs and who tends to focus on topics relating to war, peace, neutrality, international relations, and the ideas and norms that revolve around those, and I'm particularly interested in the 19th century and the First World War era. Thank you so much for having me.
On the 27th of October 2021, this new book was launched. Congratulations. You must be so excited about this. Ismay, could you perhaps tell us how the book came about? How was the idea originated and how did it evolve?
This book originated from a conference that both Maartje and I were attending back in 2014. It was a conference on First World War and neutrality. And I guess in a way it's one of these examples that, you know, you really focus on one topic for a few days with a lot of international colleagues and specialists in the field. So we had the opportunity to really reflect on basically on what it was that was annoying us. There was something wrong. We both realized that we had this same feeling of there should be something different. There's something missing. We need a different way of talking about these issues of neutrality during the First World War. I guess this unease was the beginning, and then it, as complete coincidence, it happened that Maartje and I were on the same flight to Schiphol, to Amsterdam airport. So I think it was there that we took this leap from just having this feeling of, no, there's something off, we're going to do something about it. We have actually some ideas that might get us out of this situation, that might provide new ways of thinking about neutrality and neutrals and, let's say, the unusual suspects in First World War studies. So while waiting at the airport and flying back to the Netherlands, I think it was in those hours that we conceived the book, which by then, of course, wasn't a book, but the idea came about then, and we made a lot of notes, and probably the other passengers were thinking us a bit, maybe not crazy, but but a bit of really enthusiastic and very active, and maybe a bit noisy even, because we were so much grabbed by, you know, this new idea and this new project that was starting to present itself.
I want to add to this wonderful story that Ismay has explained is that it was a really quite organic process that the origins of the book came about from our conversations at the conference, but also from our work over the many years thinking about how neutrality, and we're both historians of the First World War and the Netherlands in that war. We both did our PhDs on that subject. So we've spent many years already engaging with the concept of what it means to not be fighting, not be a belligerent in a war, yet have a stake, have a role, have an impact on that war and feel like the war is important to us or to a society. So we were really thinking about the impact of the collective of all the papers at this World War I conference, and we realized that what was missing was that in almost all the papers, our own included, we were marginalizing the war as a context in which to study these neutral societies. And we really wanted to do the exact opposite and say, well, isn't neutrality really important, central to understanding this war? And from that kind of statement, and we both agree that yes, it has to be. So from that statement came a whole bunch of ideas about, well, how do we make that more clear? How do we change or add to or develop what is the general history of this war and make it our own, make it something that incorporates neutrality as a key feature of understanding and explaining how the war evolved. That's kind of where it started. And of course, it evolved into something much more complex than that. But but it was very organic.
Thank you, Maarten Ismay. Could you perhaps elaborate a bit more on the topic of the book? What is the actual argument you and Ismay make in the book?
Most histories or general histories of the First World War tend to begin with the July crisis of 1914 and then explain how on the nights of 3-4 August, with Germany's invasion of neutral Belgium, Luxembourg and France, we get a situation where a European-wide war becomes or became inevitable. And they mobilize the invasion of Belgium to explain why Britain declares war on the 4th of August. And this is usually done within the context of explaining how the Western Front in Europe evolved. But what they look at less often is the importance, or the key importance, of Britain's declaration of war, resulting in the entire British Empire. So 446 million odd people from across literally the planet. Britain controlled 23% or so of the world's landmass at this point in time. By Britain going to war, all those 446 million people also went to war, and they brought their neighboring European controlled imperial outposts into the war as well. And that is kind of one of the key contexts in which we wrote this book. But for the people in that moment of time, on the night of 4-5 August 1914, I think the most important impact was that it destabilized their understandings of what this new world war was going to be about. Because as soon as Britain goes to war, the world is at war, because Britain controls the global economy. It's a superpower, economic superpower, imperial superpower, naval superpower, that leaves no country, no community unaffected. And I thought I would read a little bit from our book on the impact of this on the treaty port, the Chinese treaty port of Shanghai, because it's really telling, the story is really telling of how this opening act, these opening acts of war, belligerency in Europe, resulted in global anxieties, global change, and global action. Things had to change when Britain went to war. So this is from our chapter 3, which is all about Britain's declaration of war in 1914, and this is on pages 46 to 48, and it reads like this. In 1914, Shanghai was a city of strangers, a key international port of trade and commerce that thrived in the 19th century age of open seas and open commerce. Both Britain and the United States had acquired official concessions from China to run parts of the port, while the city's administration was split between various local, imperial Chinese, and foreign interests. Wealthy merchant families largely ran Shanghai, but the transnational chamber of commerce that represented the various mercantile, industrial, and banking interests in the city also wielded a considerable amount of power. With Britain's declaration of war, this transnational commercial zone could no longer sustain its networks of interdependence. The war hit locals and foreigners alike, hard and fast. Firstly, British and German ships left the port, escaping to the safer havens of Wei Hawaii, a British concession, and Tsingtao, a German concession. All other ships delayed their departure. Most of them were unsure of global shipping conditions or unable to acquire affordable maritime insurance. They feared seizure by a belligerent and were uncertain of the security of their destinations and of the economic stability of any markets for their wares. Almost no new ships arrived in port for weeks. Unemployment skyrocketed. Because there were no ships, laborers were not needed to unload them. The local silk and tea industries came to a standstill as there were no foreign buyers for these luxury items. Stock piled up in the port. Inflation hit on imported goods, but also on staples like rice. Money became scarce. Gold and silver prices shot up and gold shops closed. International business came to a standstill. The Shanghai stock market shut down and never reopened. Shanghai's telegraph stations refused to transmit coded messages to protect China's official neutrality, which it declared on 6th of August. The Transnational Chamber of Commerce, including its neutral Chinese, Japanese, and American, and belligerent British, French, and German representatives, met to discuss suitable and cooperative solutions on 8th August, but their negotiations failed and the chamber dissolved. Everyone in Shanghai hoped for a short war. They recognized a short-term economic crisis as manageable, but a long-term one was not.
Thank you for this, Marcia. The history on the Shanghai Treaty Port beautifully illustrates how belligerency in Europe reshaped not only the European environment, but actually the international environment as a whole. And I would like to zoom in on that a bit. What did the war actually meant for many communities and people all over the world? How exactly did the war impact people's daily lives?
That this Shanghai story is so important to me, and I think to the heart of the book, is that it brings out these issues of fear, anxiety, and the global impact, the global response, in a very localized, in a very real, very felt way. In Shanghai, people's fears of not being able to feed their families were heightened or were extreme as of the night of 4 or 5 August in the wake of British declaration of war. And this was true all over the world, including in all of neutral Latin America, across the United States, and certainly in trading centers across the world. And so this issue of the economic impact and the shift, which we'll get to see, which we see across the war years, to even greater economic warfare measures and the curtailing of the kinds of ways in which global trade and global economy functioned before 1914, had a real impact on ordinary people's lives everywhere. And this really brought out for me, and I think is brought out throughout the book, as being a really important theme of war. The violence of war was not just about military or personal violence. It was also about economic violence. It was about the lack of foodstuffs or inflation that made the buying of food and fuels impossible or difficult or at times so difficult that it resulted in starvation and all sorts of other really disastrous and very violent impacts. So the war and the economic parameters of the war is something that in this book we bring out not just as something that impacted on the course of the conflict and why the British and the French empires end up winning this conflict, but rather on how ordinary people in colonial spaces, in neutral spaces, and in the ever-growing number of belligerent spaces are adversely and very seriously affected by the war and by its expansion and its continuation through 14, 15, 16, 17, and then 18.
Ismay, I remember that a few days before the book launch, you proudly posted a photo in the NIOT WhatsApp group of the freshly printed copies that just arrived on your doorstep. And I remember that I was triggered by the picture on the cover. Could you please explain what we see on the picture and tell us what's it about?
The picture on the cover of the book is it's a British poster from 1915, and it was a poster that was made for the Polish Victims Relief Fund. And what you see on the picture are homeless Polish men, women and children who are carrying their possessions and are leaving a burning village. The people that you can see up front, you can see, I think, a mother carrying a baby, but you also see a man carrying his possessions on his back, and he has his face turned towards us. So if you look at the book, he kind of stares at you and he seems to ask us, like, do you see this? This is what's happening. This is, you know, what's happening to us. And what are you going to do about it? So it's when I first saw this picture, I felt both the despair of the millions of people who became refugees during the era of the First World War. It was not just in Poland, it was not just in Europe. It was massive all around the globe, and not only during those years, but also in the years afterwards, and in many ways up until now, of course. And having somebody staring at you, not in a way like, oh, this is your fault, or look what you did, but more like, you know, this is it, this is what's happening, be aware of it. I think that was what attracted me to this drawing of this scene.
Thank you, Ismay. Marcie, the book offers a wide-ranging history of the ways people and societies all over the world experienced the First World War. What kind of sources did you use?
The collection of sources for this book is in itself really interesting. I don't think the book could have become what it was without the enormous and incredibly exciting amount of work that was both inspired by and published during the centennial years, so the 100-year celebrations, or rather commemorations of the conflict. So between 2014 and 2018, all over the world, in what were both belligerent and neutral and non-belligerent communities, scholars, historians were inspired to research their community, their experiences of this war. And it was an enormously rich and complex picture, It's a rainbow of amazing histories for Ismay and I to read and mobilize. And many of our most important stories, including some of the individual stories we bring out in the book, come from this particular time frame and these amazing scholars' work. But I guess we also really relied on our collective reading of previous historiography. So for me personally, two of the most important sources for this book were quite a lot older ones. So Catherine Meyer's 1985 article on Shanghai was really formative to me in thinking about this war as having global importance and global impact, as was Tim Stapleton's 1990s work on the Wagogo people who suffered enormous starvation and a complete discombobulation of their community due to the war in East Africa between 1914 and 1918. And so it was finding these rich histories that have been so long left at the peripheries of the study of World War I that I found the inspiration for many of the themes in the book as well.
Thank you, Marja. Yeah, so you explained that you prioritized experiences that are usually made peripheral to emphasize how transformative the war was for many communities. And this obviously stresses the importance of the book, I think. And this made me wonder, what is it that we can learn from the book for our present-day society, Ismay?
I think why this book is important now is that it, well, at least when writing it, I became aware on a much deeper level of how much of the problems that we are facing in our world today are basically the problems that radicalized during the First World War. So the problems of inequality, violence, extraction, destruction. Of course, all these things existed before 1914, and it's not that nothing has changed, but we never really solved any of the huge problems that came about during those years. The global impact of the violence, the continuing of it in different forms until today, and also the inability of the great powers back then and still now in many ways, the inability of the dominant groups, Western European, American, mainly white groups, their inability to really realize what in fact was happening, even though there were so many voices, and we tried to highlight them in our book as well. There were so many voices asking, especially the imperial great powers, please change your behavior, please stop doing this, stop the nationalism, stop the subjection of other people, stop the violence, and stop thinking you are superior and that you have the right to impose all this on the rest of the world. And I think paying attention to the voices of the people who were back then raising these issues already, while at the same time when I stopped working on the book and I looked around or I listened to the news, it felt as if nothing really had changed. It was in the midst of the pandemic, of course, the Black Lives Matter protests, the climate crisis protests, and also the growing awareness of all these issues, and that by now we really have to address this. And part of addressing this is looking at your own position, like for me in Western Europe, in an academic context, look at your own position, like, okay, how can we start moving away from these long violent traditions that are so deeply entrenched in our cultures, and that we haven't yet started to really look into and to really transform, to move away from. So for me, that's one of the ways in which it is very relevant for today.
Maartje and Ismee, thank you both very much for this interview. It was lovely to have you. I believe the book is also available as an open access text, right? Then I can put the link on the website.
Yes, the book is available via the website of the publisher. It's on the Bloomsbury website, and indeed it's also open access available right now.
Such a pleasure and honour to be able to take part in this podcast and to talk about and indulge my reminiscences of how the book came about and what it means to me. So thank you.